step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Let's say you go to Mount Vernon and you find a piece of George Washington's hair or some other piece of DNA. And let's also say that you're a genetic engineer or a mad scientist like Rick from Rick and Morty, and you have the ability to clone George Washington. Would you do that? And even if you could, would that person be George Washington? That's a question that was asked by someone who is in his own way a clone of George Washington, Austin Washington. And Austin, if you're listening to this interview, I know you'll be annoyed by that, but Austin is the great, 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 great nephew of George Washington, a descendant of him. But he also wrote a book called The Education of George Washington, How a Forgotten Book Shaped the Character of a Hero. And his argument is that a book that Washington got when he was 15 years old that a brother gave to him is what fundamentally shaped his character, gave him virtue, and overall gave him that aura of greatness that when he would walk onto the battlefield or in a room, people could sense that about him. Their instincts told them that this was a person that had greatness, and it wasn't from his DNA, it was from what he learned. So Austin argues that it's this book that he read that he applied the lessons throughout his life that led to his greatness. And through this, he was able to overcome a lot of hardship. His father died when he was young, so even though his brothers were sent to this exclusive school in England, George wasn't, so that's why he went out to seek his own fortune, to become a surveyor when he was 15 years old, to keep good accounts so that he could run his plantation well, to successfully lead the Continental Army to become the first president, and to lay down the traditions among presidents that prevented America from falling into tyranny and not falling into a dictatorship, which is pretty hard when you're in a presidential system. Look at places in Africa or Latin America where they have fallen to presidential dictatorships. So Austin and I get into all these aspects of his life and we jump all over the place. It's kind of a gonzo interview, but I had a lot of fun with it. And I think you will too in this discussion with Austin Washington.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Austin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to ask you about your background, and maybe there are some things that are true and maybe there's family lore that's bendable, but could you tell me about your background and your connection to George Washington?
Yeah, well, I have been several times in my life the sort of designated George Washington guy at Mount Vernon, because they like to have a relative around once in a while. And my family still owns one of his brother's houses. And so I sort of spent my childhood looking at this large picture of one of his brothers and seeing a small, and this is actually, I'm not making, it sounds like a good story and it is, but it's actually true. And I saw this small picture of George in the kitchen. And I knew that George Washington hadn't had any children. So I kind of thought of George as kind of the poor, sad brother whose picture, you know, they still have it, but it's in the kitchen. But the important brothers were the ones whose big pictures were in the main rooms of the house. And so I learned slowly that wasn't the way most of the world saw George Washington.
How many generations are you removed from him?
I guess it depends how you count them. I guess seven, I think, is the right number.
Okay, so great times six, uncle?
I think that's what it is, yeah.
Okay. So what got you into this project where you looked at his educational background? And your argument is that there's a book that most people don't know about that really formed his ideology. Was it family curiosity or was it something else that made you want to do this?
No, it was trying to avoid having a real job.
Always a good way to do it. Yeah.
It actually worked out well for me. I was still studying when I got this book contract, and they kind of thought, I mean, I love writing. I've written my whole life. It's my great passion. I love debating and proving points. And I like writing persuasively. And so I thought I would like to write a book about George Washington. But when I went in to see Regnery, that was kind of all I had. And they were like, well, I guess that would be good, but what's the book about? And I was like, George Washington? And I said, yeah. And? I was like, let me think about it. And so I went to have lunch with Dr. Theodore, God, I think that's his right name, Theodore Crackle, who at the time was the head of the George Washington Papers Project. And I think mostly when I did interviews and when people talked to me when this book first came out, it wasn't made clear. It was as if I had made this discovery. Dr. Crackle made this discovery but it's amazing. The first purchase of George Washington's life, well, there were three things on this receipt. One was this book. And no one had sort of noticed this before. You know, they're still organizing his papers. And so the first purchase of George Washington's life was a book about, in essence, it was a self-help book of his day. And so, because George Washington's father died when George Washington was much younger than 15 when he bought this book, when he was eight, as I recall, he had the influence of his older half-brothers, both of whom had gone to a kind of prep school called Appleby in England. I guess prep isn't exactly the right term because they weren't preparing necessarily for university, but, you know, the equivalent of a prep school, whatever, you know, a good, right, expensive high school. And his father died, so he didn't have the money to go to the school he really wanted to. So he ended up going to this little school in the countryside where he learned more pragmatic things like, you know, surveying and mathematics and accounting, which actually helped him quite a bit. But he was always self-conscious about his lack of education. By the way, I didn't want to call this book The Education of George Washington, which is its name. I wanted to call it George Washington's Guide to Greatness, but I was overruled by Regnery.
I think of the miseducation of Lauryn Hill when I hear it, but yeah. Hey, it works.
Well, I think there is the education of some Indian. Now I can't even think of what it is. I think they were just basically borrowing from that title. But if it were up to me, I would have focused just on his childhood, because it was really interesting. One of the things I studied when I was studying this stuff is just about the way children were different in prior times. They weren't viewed the same way. I mean, without going into all sorts of theory, you know, I mean, what's his face? Lafayette had some kind of, not exactly an officership, but he was a kind of officer when he was 11. And George Washington, of course, when he was 15, stopped his country school. And for the rest of his life, he felt self-conscious about not having a proper education, but went off to sort of make his way in the world. Well, I mean, think today, if what would happen to the mother of a boy who was running, you know, into the woods where he ran into, you know, Indians carrying scalps and all these crazy adventures he had, but all these dangerous situations he found himself in. You know, his mother would be thrown in prison. He'd be sent to, you know, a foster home. But I kind of forget your question. But the point is, he, you know, back then, people grew up a lot faster.
Right. Is this when he goes off to do his surveying when he's 15 years old?
Yeah. At first he was sort of assisting one of his one of the Fairfaxes. But the point, sorry, I'm, you said you wouldn't edit this. So I've kind of I've not talked about this since 2014, so I'm kind of, my mind is a little rusty. Oh, but can I tell you something else that I found really fascinating? When we think about education, I never mentioned this when I did a ton of interviews when this book first came out. But you, one of the things you said in your email was, tell me about the education of the time. And it was varied. Now, the thing that's relevant to George Washington and relevant to history and relevant to people who are interested in this subject is that, you know, at the time, everyone, forget education, just the culture was imbued with all of these stories and images from, you know, what we call the ancient world, you know, Greece and Rome, and all the stories and all the heroes and all the lessons and all the anti-heroes and all of that stuff was known by everybody. I mean, it was on the plates and on the curtains and, you know, in the stories. And there was that famous, you know, The Spectator, that series of magazines was sort of reprinted, or I don't know if it was reprinted, but bound and sold and, you know, known throughout the colonies. And so what everyone saw the world through this paradigm. Everyone saw the world through all the lessons of what was good and what worked and what was bad and what didn't work in the ancient world. And this, rather than the, you know, education per se, was, I think, what made everyone, not everyone, but made lots of people agree on the way the world ought to be transformed by, you know, for example, the revolution. And it also informed what they thought about how a person should be. And so when George Washington got this Guide to Greatness, which was, it was a panegyric to, it's been so long since I've talked about it, a panegyric to the memory of His Grace Frederick, late Duke of Schoenberg. And it was kind of a hagiographic book about this man who was about a generation before George Washington, just talking about his virtues and the phrase that the term of art was a Christian gentleman. And of course, George Washington wasn't a Christian in the way that people in New England were at that time. He, you know, famously, I don't know if you know this, when he was president, somebody complained that he wasn't staying for, wasn't taking part in the communion. So instead of taking part in the communion, he didn't go on that Sunday. So he wasn't that sort of a Christian, but he still was a Christian gentleman. He embodied these values. And so the book that he bought when he was 15, that the argument of my book, The Education of George Washington, made, is that since he didn't have a father, and since his brothers kind of, you know, had a kind of English education, the thing that actually gave him his American character, like his Roman character, his spirit, was this book that he got when he was 15. Was, I think, very important. Had he gone to those schools, to that school, for example, Appleby, that his older half-brothers had gone to, he would have just been, I think, a less tough, I mean, clearly, he would have been a less tough, less self-reliant person. I mean, when he went to his little pragmatic school in the countryside, he learned accounting, and he accounted for every penny he ever spent. This is why we know that this was his first purchase, because he accounted for it. And that really helped him. You know, a lot of those farmers back then, those plantation owners, went broke, and he didn't. He did a really good job, and he, you know, varied his crops and, you know, didn't do just tobacco and all that kind of stuff. And he was very, very intelligent. And because he started being a surveyor when he was 15, he got really, really good at that. And that was kind of, I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but it was kind of like, you know, the stock market or something of his day. And so he made good investments and did well. And he did much better than any of his sort of older half-brothers or other brothers. And I think a good reason for this is, you know, his innate character and all of that, but also this book that taught him some really, really important lessons. And that was the point of my book.
Was the book called The Guide to Greatness?
No, that's what I wanted to my book. Okay. My book is called The Education of George Washington. The book he bought was called A Panegyric to the Memory of His Grace, Frederick, Late Duke of Schoenberg.
I see, panegyric. That is a nice word right there for the GRE.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yeah, exactly.
I think I had that one. So it describes this character. Can you tell me about this character that this panegyric is for?
He was a military, you know, it's just, it's been 3 years since I've even thought of it.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to reach back there in the brain and pull it out.
I suffered after my university, I suffered from this thing I like to call it, what was it? PTL, the post-literary, whatever, post-literary stress disorder. And like, it was just amazing how I knew everything about everything. And like a month later, I couldn't remember a word. He was basically an officer. See, my problem is I'm conflating him with somebody much less noble in my mind. And I don't want to talk about two people at once. He was an officer that rose through the ranks on his own character. He was recognized by other people as having a great character. And even though he was born kind of into an okay family, he still got ahead because he was a Christian gentleman, you know? Okay. In essence, that's what it was. Which is kind of what... Sorry, go.
No, go ahead.
I forget. Your turn. Go.
Well, was this book popular at all?
No.
Huh.
I don't think so. I don't think it was terrible. Well, I'll tell you, when I first started this book, I Googled the name of this book and there were zero references on Google. And that's a pretty difficult thing to find. After I started writing it, before the book was out, somebody somewhere had made a small printing of it, but you couldn't, as I recall, it wasn't even in the Library of Congress. It was a very, very obscure book by the time, you know, I started writing this book about 6 years ago.
How did you find it?
Well, as I said, I had lunch at the Army Navy Club with Dr. Theodore Crackle.
I think that is in the
intro to my book. I think because I couldn't get in touch with him by email, I didn't have permission to use his name. So I referred to him as Dr. X.
Professor X.
I should say, if anyone's interested in the book, my book, The Education of George Washington, I'm no longer flogging it, but someone drove like 100 miles, just some little talk I give. I didn't give a lot of talks. I did lots of TV stuff, but to tell me it made her laugh out loud and taught an important lesson. And the guy who reviewed it said it was the best book ever written about George Washington, and it's still 4.5 stars on Amazon. So it's actually fun to read, I'm told. As I said, if it were up to me, I would have just focused on his youth. What the book actually does is go through his entire life and sort of seen through the prism of this book he bought when he was 15. And so after the first two or three chapters, that book that he bought when he was 15, you know, works more as a literary device, functions more as a literary device than actually, you know, I just take qualities from a panegyric to the memory of his father, and put them at the head of each chapter and talk about something that happened in the next stage of George Washington's through that prism. So that's the way the book is set up.
What are some other things that come out? You mentioned keeping rigorous accounts so that you don't default, your plantation can operate well, and he does this. What are other things that you see pulled out from this book that Washington applies in his life?
Oh, see, I must speak far too quickly. My point about that was because he went to this pragmatic country school, he learned pragmatic things like that at his country school, rather than having gone to Appleby in England, where he probably would know Greek and Latin, but wouldn't know how to balance his checkbook. Or what, not checkbook, but, you know, accounting book. As for what he got from this book, upon which my book was based, I could just go through the chapters and tell you. Strength and vivacity, to have an affable, candid, and obliging nature. All of these sound silly out of context, but the point is to put them in context and make them sound important, you know, as important as they are if you take it out of sort of late 17th century language, because I guess the book upon the panegyric was written, I think, in the 1690s, as I recall. So his duty was his greatest passion. Then I have one chapter called The Coolest American. Hey, man, this was a long time ago I wrote this. The most surprising dangers near betrayed him in any fear, exacting to the rules of civility, breeding, and all the accomplishments of men of quality, blah, blah, blah. So things like that, you know. I'm really shocked when I look at my table of contents now. I mean, I don't know if your listeners know, but, you know, if you write a book, you tend not to look at it after you've written it because you just can't face it.
Right.
I cannot believe it's one of the, I cannot believe this is a chapter in this book. Can I just tell you?
Sure.
I just can't believe how they let me publish this. Chapter 12 is called George Washington, Cincinnatus, and Bozo the Clown. Don't ask me I can't face it at this point.
How do you put those two together? I'd love to hear that.
I don't know. I don't remember. But I will tell you, I mean, I'll tell you the good thing about writing a book like this is this was, as far as I know, I could be corrected. The television show they did about this book for PBS is the only full television show dedicated to George Washington they've ever done. That might not be true, but I tried to Google it and find if there was anything else, and I couldn't find anything. So I got a whole half-hour TV show on PBS about this. So it was, so writing in a way that people would find enjoyable accomplished one of my goals, which was to make people, you know, to reach people who wouldn't normally read a book about George Washington. The sad truth about books in America is, as someone at Regner told me, if someone who might buy a book won't buy a book. Someone who will buy a book might buy a book.
Hmm.
And so, in fact, you know, the market for George Washington books is more history buffs. And I was hoping that this would, you know, appeal to other people. And like the lady I told you who drove over 100 miles to see me speak and said it made her laugh out loud and taught her an important lesson, did some kind of organizing of students who came to Washington, D.C. from around, you know, high school students, I guess, middle school students. And she wanted to use my book or use me to do some teaching of those students. And I kind of, at that point, I didn't want to be a professional relative of George Washington. It's kind of an embarrassing position to find yourself in. And I just didn't want to do anything about this book anymore. I mean, I'm glad I wrote it. I'm glad it really, people really liked it. The other thing I thought was amazing was when I did this show for PBS, the guy, the host of the show, I don't remember how old they were, maybe, I guess they were teenagers, but his kids and their friends all came in because they really, really wanted to see me, and they were really like excited about the book. And so it was nice to be able to write a book in a way that people who aren't history buffs or history nerds, will get something out of it. But, unless you've got $1 million to flog this in, they're probably not going to find out about it.
And you don't want to be too associated, so you spend the rest of your life at at Colonial Williamsburg in the suit.
I got offered like a lot of money. I mean, like a lot of money to go and do speeches at, and I don't even remember where, like the Palm Desert Homeowners Association. There's things like that, and I went through the phase of they wanted a little. I mean, there was a point where I just said I cannot do this. I just can't show up. Like, I'm fine when it's like I'm at Mount Vernon, it's a bunch of like people who just happen to be there and kids from all over the world and they think it's cool or whatever. Something sticks in my mind though. I was in Russia once talking about this, don't ask why. And there's a little tiny announcement for like press somewhere, I don't know. And this is not atypical. And some guy showed up and I kind of end up being in the position as a relative of Elvis would be. You know, there are lots of people who like Elvis, and that's great. But the people who come to the event are the ones who like him a little too much. And it's weird in a way you can't understand. I got a 14-page pencil-written double-sided letter about like Masonic conspiracies once hand-delivered. I got another hand delivered, you know, and it's just, I don't like things that are hand delivered. That bothers me. And so my goal was to make George Washington kind of accessible, but it's just so, you know, I mean, that was 2014 when it came out. And I think, you know, one or two more years and everyone will be treating George Washington the way they are treating, you know, Jefferson now, you know? I mean, you all the anti, you know, all that stuff, all those protests,
right? Where it's
I'll just go on the record and say this: George Washington inherited slaves; he freed them. What in his will? Why didn't he free them earlier? It was against the law to free them unless you could provide for them in Virginia. So he had to have enough money to pay for their houses and all their stuff, and he did it. And long before the Revolution even happened, he was writing about there's some document he wrote, and I wish I could recall what it was offhand, but where he wasn't, and the other thing I said to somebody who asked me about this once, it's like John Lennon talked about a brotherhood of man, not a brotherhood of people. You know, you are born when you're born into the society in which you're born. And as long as you're going the right direction, it's the most you can do. And people, and you know, anyone today who buys an iPhone is enslaving people at Foxconn in China, not exactly enslaving, but kind of, you know? And so he did the most he could possibly do, and no one's perfect. That's my defense.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, that's an interesting issue there, because I had a guest a few months ago who was a Jefferson impersonator, but not in the colonial Williamsburg sense, where he would, people would ask him questions and he would first answer as Jefferson would, because he really believed in his enlightenment spirit. And then once that was done, he'd sort of step aside and be out of character and critique. Okay, well, Jefferson was a man of time. So on the one hand, it's lazy to say, oh, he had slaves, he's bad, I'm enlightened, I'll just completely write him off. So you have to understand the context, but get out of the person of the times and look at sort of that universal human spirit and the good he did for society. So you mentioned that with Washington, that it's lazy to just write him off because of the slavery thing, but how would you answer that? Of what are the aspects of his character that you think that are part of this universal human good? And then what are things that, just getting beyond the times, and he's a man of his time, so we can't fault him for that, that would be negative things?
Well, to me, the thing that maybe it's just my personal predilection, but he wasn't religious, even though he went to church sometimes and was a vestryman, but what's funny about George Washington is he would write about the same incident throughout his life. And there was this incident where a horse was shot out from under him, and there were bullets through his coat and his hat. And I've read his version of it in three times and written it three separate times in his life. And the number of horses increases, the number of bullets increase as his life goes. So he had a healthy self-image, but there was this incident where he had however many bullets through his hat and through his coat, and of course it shot out from under him. And I might be conflating, because it's been a couple of years, I might be conflating stories, but there was also this Indian marksman at one point who was specifically told to shoot George Washington. And so after the battle was over, well, I'll stick with the Indian for now. So the Indian, after a while, gave up. He said he's obviously protected by the divine spirit, because he just couldn't hit him. And after the thing was over, he wrote to his... Again, there are enough history nerds out there that if I get one thing wrong, they'll be aware of it. I think his commanding officer, to say that, this happened. But when he wrote to his favorite brother, he said, I don't want to say the words wrong, because I don't think he used the word miracle, but he basically had this idea that there was a thing called providence, and providence protected him. Providence sort of guided him in a particular direction. And because he was doing the thing that this greater power wanted, it kind of protected him. And his belief, again and again throughout his life, did he express this, was that there was this higher power that was intelligent. It wasn't a deist thing or whatever. It was intelligent, and it had a purpose for him, and he had a purpose. And if he was doing what his purpose was, he would be protected. And I know I used to believe that when I first had a driving license. I don't know how accurate it was. But So to me, that's kind of my favorite. Well, at least that's the thing that speaks to me the most. And that's kind of a universal thing, because it's kind of, it's a part, you know, and on the other hand, you know, he did say at one point, I guess it was his farewell thingy, but he you know, he talked, I can't quote him off the top of my head, I'm sorry, George Washington buffs, but he talked about how, you know, religion, you know, is important for society, but he himself, though he was involved in his church in certain ways, didn't believe in it enough to take part in communion, but he did believe in it enough, in his own way at least, or in something connected to it, to really feel and experience that there was something kind of miraculous happening in his life. And, you know, I think there's a guy called a Scottish name, and he wrote a book called, oh, I'm going to get all of this wrong. I think it could be Master and, oh, forget it. Google it. But yeah. He wrote a book about, it's so interesting though. It's about how the left brain and the right brain, in popular culture, it's simplified and it's not exactly right, but there is something to it. And so, you know, you know all the cliches about that. But he said, it's interesting if you see society, it goes through these same kind of periods where, you know, everything's all like in Baroque and, you know, everything's curved and decorated and filigreed. And today we're in a world where, you know, all the skyscrapers are straight, or most of them, except that, you know, that guy in never mind. I'm trying to make an offhand comment about that guy who made that very strange museum in Spain. You know what I'm talking about?
In Barcelona?
You know what I'm talking about.
The church? So. Yeah, Gaudi.
No. The guy who, it's this new kind of architecture where you don't have to have straight lines. But the point is, the buildings in our era are straight, and the paths we go through life are straight. I had a girlfriend, and she only knew how to get high scores and apply to things online. That's all she could do. You know, she got perfect score, got a scholarship, went to the right school, did the right numbers, did the right. And whereas if you go into the periods of time that might be represented by the other hemisphere of your brain, you know, everyone's superstitious and believing crazy things and everything's disorganized. But, you know, this kind of time when George Washington lived was kind of a melding of those two things.
Huh.
There was the Enlightenment and people were trying to be more rational and think things through in that way. But they still had this kind of belief in nobility and you know, just the power of the right ideas as being more than just residing in your brain, but residing out there somewhere, which is why George Washington felt safe, or at least in retrospect, felt he had been protected when people were shooting at him, because he felt he was doing the right thing. And I think it's a good period of time. And I think George Washington himself embodied those two strains. He was a man of the Enlightenment to a degree, but he was still a man who believed, he wasn't religious in a superstitious way, but he still believed in the power of something that he couldn't understand or explain. So
that's interesting. You mentioned the two halves of the brain, because this period in the middle of the 18th century and later, it's really the inflection point where people in the West are really starting to see visible progress in their own lifetimes. And a century before, one of the big arguments in Europe was, do the ancients hold the wisdom that we cannot surpass? There's never going to be another Homer. There's never going to be another Seneca. And then modernists would say, well, we're surpassing them with logic and mathematics and other things. But 100 years later, at the time of Washington, that's really settled, where people are able to see visible progress in their own lives. And they can see the growth curve of wealth, of technology, of other things like that, of intellectual achievements. But there's, like you said, still that spirit that the ancients have something to teach us, whereas now in the 21st century, the growth curve is so high that we almost can't do anything but just sneer at our ancestors and think they have nothing to teach us because of XYZ, like the slavery thing we talked about earlier.
Yeah, but you know the movie Avatar, where the world had an intelligence? Sometimes I feel like our part of the world is so much that way that it's almost inevitable crazy religious people have to sprout up in other parts of the world, you know? Or like Russia has to, you know, the more we promote one kind of view of semi-Western society, the more Russia has, you know what I mean? It somehow seems like there's some balancing going on. Like you can't, I don't know, maybe it's not true, but it's my impression.
Something else too with Washington's background I thought was interesting. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Can I just say one thing that's so interesting? It just occurred to me about what people. I was so shocked. I just was flipping a copy of The Spectator, which most of your listeners will know, and I probably will get the dates wrong. It was written by Addison and some other guy. What's his name? Do you know offhand?
I do not.
You don't. Okay. Okay. So I think the year, it was like 1708 to 11 or something like that. But it was such a popular thing that it was in everyone's library in the colonies. But I was just flipping through one, and there was some speculation about what the people on, I forget if it was Mars or Venus or something, looked like. And I just had no idea that in 1711, in a popular magazine, you read at coffee houses or wherever they read these things, people kind of accepted there were probably creatures like us on other planets. It just absolutely astounded me, because I just thought that came much, much, much more recently.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry. Yeah,
no, that's fascinating. You'd think, oh, H.G. Wells created the idea of the Martian, and that's what did it.
But, yeah. It's somewhere in the spectrum. Anyway, so what was your question? Sorry.
Well, when you mentioned this Pangyric, I'm always mispronouncing.
I always say panegyric.
You're probably right, as listeners have lovingly noticed over time. Yeah. I mispronounce a lot of things, but hey, take it as it is.
Well, it's Panegyric. Panegyric. Anyways, I'm going for panegyric.
Sounds good, panegyric. I'll follow your lead on that.
But it would be a gyroscope, wouldn't it? It would be a gyroscope, and it's GY, so panegyric. Anyway, I'm sorry. What's your question?
That he reads this and the way he applies it to his life, and that the argument you make, it's interesting because it almost sounds like self-help, the type of books that become popular in the early 20th century, the Dale Carnegie, the Napoleon Hill, all these people. But was this type of understanding of self-help and becoming a self-made man, was this something that was people were doing in the 18th century, or was he really revolutionizing something, for lack of a better term, pun intended?
What an excellent question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. Let me think of, well, of course, you know, you had Benjamin Franklin, didn't you?
Well, yeah, that's a good one.
I mean, that, so I would say, but I tend to think it, I mean, my feeling, well, you know, you all can always find something that predates something that you think is the first of something, you know. I'm sure Benjamin Franklin wasn't the first to do something like that. But certainly, I can't say with any authority when it started, but I would certainly say that, you know, Benjamin Franklin had readers for the kind of thing he was writing, which was designed for people to help themselves. So I would say that it probably was in the air, wasn't it? Look at that.
Yeah.
There's my answer. Discovered in mid-sentence.
There it is. It takes that process of describing it. But like one of your main theses is that everyone says The Rules of Civility is the book that really guides him, and you're saying it wasn't. Now, I don't know what's in that book. So what is in The Rules of Civility?
It's just so stupid. It's just some, it's not. What is it? It was a writing exercise, apparently, and people just found it and tried to hawk it at, you know, Mount Vernon as some tchotchke, if that's the right word, when he visited. No, it's just something. It was a writing exercise. There's no evidence that he had cared about it or had anything. You know, he wrote it, I think, as a writing exercise, probably. This is entirely different. This not only was something that because he recorded everything he wrote, not only was this the first book of his life, it was the only book he bought for, I think, about 3 years. It was his only book. And you got to think, the other point is, you know, he was spending some time in his half-brother's one or both of his half-brother's houses, where there were libraries. He had access to lots and lots of books. So if he were to go out and spend a large amount of money for a 15-year-old on a book, it was an important thing. So I think there's no doubt that he lugged this around with him. I mean, you can imagine him reading it when he was out there doing surveying, maybe not. But I mean, I think the evidence, the logical inference, is that this was very, very important to him, and it really did affect him. There's no other reason he would have chosen to buy it when he had access to countless other books.
Books were expensive back then. It'd be something like hundreds of dollars compared to today for just one book.
Don't ask me to do the math. I'll take your word on that.
You gotta be wealthy to do it. I don't know about Rules of Civility. Is Now, I understood it was a book you acquired. No, it's
just stuff like if you put spittle on the floor, make sure to dexterously cover it with your foot. That's about what it says. Stuff like that. That's one of the things. It's just a bunch of rules that are silly. Like, you know, if you're in the fire, don't spit in. A lot of stuff about spitting. There's nothing to do with it's just hokum and bunkum. The fact that it was had any influence on George Washington other than a passing one. I mean, I think that's my opinion.
It sounds like something that would be at a girls' finishing school during the Great Depression. Just these, rules to fit into society.
But the assumptions of the rules are a lot cruder. I mean, like I said, there are a lot of them about spitting, as I recall off the top of my head. I could Google it as we speak and look at them, but I'm not going to bother. But as I recall, the one I recall is like if you spit on the floor, dexterously cover it with your foot, something like that. They're nothing like something that would be seen now. But the point is, they kind of assume this sort of lack of manners that one would have found, I would think, long before George Washington was around. I mean, it assumes a kind of crudeness. It's stopping people from doing really disgusting things. It's not like Miss Whoever's whatever, you know, guide to manners for the Upper East Side. It's just silly. It's just, it was a writing exercise, I think. There's no evidence he cared about it.
Right.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.
And from what you gathered looking at this, I've already forgot the pronunciation, panegyric.
But you can find it, oh, listeners, in The Education of George Washington. 4.5 stars on Amazon.
There you are.
I should have said it's reprinted in the back of my book, which you can get. I'll just tell you this so they'll find it out anyway. It's quite cheap secondhand on Amazon. So, you know, get yourself a secondhand one.
Oh, yeah.
Or get the audio version or the, what's the other one? Or the, you know, the iPad version, whatever it is, Kindle.
Kindle, yeah.
I'm sorry. So tell me, so to ask your question.
From what you saw here, in your description of his education, this book that he has that you think really guides him, what was your takeaway after you finished the book of, these are lessons that we can learn that Washington applied these lessons to his life. So what do you see as the takeaway from this story?
It's a combination of two things. You know, the problem with a lot of societies throughout history is that you are stuck doing what your parents or grandparents had done, doing what society told you to do. But now we kind of think, you know, everything's open to the extent that people kind of forget some really important things that are really valuable and really work. And what was interesting about the lessons in this book is that I think they're kind of universal. And I'm reminded of the time I was walking with this guy who, and I saw his passport, it's true. He was a lord of, he was an Afghani lord, he really was.
Wow.
And we were walking down a really dodgy street somewhere. And there are these people burning something in the middle of the road, like a bunch of people who looked like they could be in some kind of gang or something and was certainly up to no good and might have knives and things. And this, he was a big guy, but he wasn't like superhuman. I just walked up to them with no fear whatsoever and told them in a polite way to stop. And they did. And that's the kind of power George Washington had. And I noticed when I was growing up, you know, people in a certain, who belonged to a certain club or something, they might, you know, have some, or had a certain profession, the people immediately around them might give them a kind of respect that their position owed, but they didn't inherently have that kind of real power.
Right.
But George Washington had a real power that came from, I mean, hey, he was physically tall like this Afghan lord, but also he, you know, he had unshakable character. He had unshakable convictions. And it just sounds so nerdy and geeky in our time to say things like that, like, which is why I bring the Afghani lord. I mean, this guy was cool as hell. But he had a kind of power that came from just, you know, I use the word Christian gentleman, but you can also think about, I can't think, you know, there's nobility. He was noble in the real sense of the word, not in the sense of drunk as a lord, you know, but in the sense of
Having this stately character. He didn't just inherit some title or land.
Yeah. But also he didn't necessarily inherit the character. He learned the character. And that's what makes it so beautifully American. As I recall, and again, I'm conflating him with somebody else, and I don't want to get this wrong, but the guy in the book, I forget exactly, he did work his way up, you know, from court to court and war to war and army to army. And ended up being a duke in England, as I recall, at the end of it, but he didn't start out that way. So he, so there is some kind of, but what I want, but when I, if I tie this back to what I said earlier about George Washington having this belief in providence, there is something more than you can think about that happens when you have this kind of character. People see it in certain people. These guys burning stuff in the middle of the road, they saw it. They just, people can see when someone is great. And I think what's interesting about this book that George Washington read is that this sort of the guide to greatness was passed on to him, not through his family, though he actually did buy the book from one of his cousins, but from another great person. And that there is this kind of genuine thing that's not a put on, that's not something that you can just think about, but it's something you can become. And you become it if you align yourself with something that, you know, throughout history, some people align themselves with. And I can't, you know, if it could be put any more simply than that, everyone could do it. But I forget your question, but did that answer it?
Yeah, that answers it really well. The idea, how do you get this kind of indescribable quality of greatness? Yeah. What does it mean? And it's not just this inherited thing, but the je ne sais quoi some other guests, he described what you just said when in, I think it was a guest who talked about the World War II general Curtis LeMay, and he was interviewing Robert McNamara, the former Secretary of State. And although he disagreed with McNamara on a lot of things in the Cold War, this book author said being in his presence, he felt like what you just said about this Afghani lord or George Washington, the sort of the aura of greatness surrounding him. If people want to learn more about your writings, in addition to this book and others, is there a place that they can find you online?
Well, yeah, I have this. If you go to austinwashington.com/George, you get this book. God only knows, excuse me for using the name Lord's name in vain. That wasn't exactly vain. It was just being perturbed slightly. But I don't know what's on that website. It's not been updated in so long. I just don't like the internet much these days. I also have a Facebook page, which it's really weird. Like 10 or 20 people fan me or like me or friend me or whatever they do every week. And I post something once every 6 months. But it's... Facebook.com/AustinWashington or AustinWashington.com. But for this book, it's AustinWashington.com/George. I'm working on something right now that I'm not doing under my name just because I don't like, you know, the whole George Washington connection bothers me sometimes. But maybe I'll put a few hints about it somewhere on my Facebook page if people are interested. But there's nothing there. The last thing I posted is probably 6 months ago. I'm sorry. I'm not, you know.
Well, hey, all those people who like sleuthing all our little miniature Encyclopedia Browns can try to see what the next Prodigy is. They want to find it. Well, hey, this is a great starting point, and I think people want to check it out. So thanks for sharing us all these things with us, Austin. Thank you for joining us. That was the discussion with Austin. I'll include links to his website, his Facebook group, however irregularly or irregularly it might be updated. And if you ever have a question for me that you would like to answer, we talked about what would a founding father be like if they came into the 21st century. You can ask a question of how would Thomas Jefferson act if you were walking around today? You can send a question like that or any other question you want about history to info@historyonthenet.com or historyunplugpodcast.com, where you'll find instructions to send an email or leave a voicemail. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.